Texas could see more gas power plants to meet demand for computing power related to artificial intelligence. I'm Joshua Zinn, in for Craig Cohen. Today on Houston Matters, we talk with Houston Chronicle reporter Claire Howe about why and where these new plants might show up.
Houston Matters with Craig Cohen is a production of Houston Public Media with support from Baylor College of Medicine.
Also this hour, Brenda Valdivia talks with actor, comedian, and noted comic book fan Patton Oswalt ahead of his upcoming visit to Comicpalooza. Also ahead, we talk about traveling with your pets for the summer and welcome your general dog and cat care questions at talk@houstonmatters.org. Plus, how an athlete's off-the-field conduct affects their reputation and that of their teams. We'll start with a news update from NPR and local headlines from News 88.7. Stay with us. This is Houston Matters. I'm Joshua Zinn, in for Craig Cohen. Good morning. Coming up this hour, a conversation with comedian and actor Patton Oswalt, who is one of many notable names that will be at this year's Comicpalooza. We also answer your pet care questions, which you can send now to talk@houstonmatters.org. And we'll talk about how player conduct off the field can affect the professional sports teams that they play for. But first... Sounds from the No Kings protest in downtown Houston this past Saturday. As you heard in our newscast, an estimated 15,000 Houstonians showed up downtown, along with hundreds at other protests in the area and millions of fellow Americans in similar events across the country. Houston Matters producer Mincho Jacobs spoke with protesters, including Richard Cappuccino. Like many we heard from at the event, this was his first time ever coming out to a protest.
It's worth coming to because I felt helpless at home, doing nothing, just watching the news. You know, to see a U.S. senator thrown to the ground, a Hispanic U.S. senator thrown to the ground, makes you wonder what is going on in this country of mine, you know?
And do you plan to come out to more?
Sure. I like this. I like the taste of it. It feels good. It's American. This is what democracy looks like.
Gretchen Gillis was worried about the weather affecting turnout, but happy to see so many out peacefully exercising their rights.
I'm here because I believe in our system of government with three equal branches, due process, and adherence to the Constitution. It's delightful to see so many people here peacefully. I love seeing the artistry of the signs. Houston has a great creative community, and people are really peacefully exercising their First Amendment rights. It's great.
While many present expressed support for Democrats, there were many Republicans who felt motivated to join the protest as well. Calvin Rudy is a registered Republican and has voted with the GOP his entire life.
The comments that Donald Trump has made, I think, harm what the Republican Party's actual goals should be. In particular, the way that due process rights have been trampled on is embarrassing. I think if somebody has a reason to be convicted of this, that, or the other thing, you should be able to show it in court.
And that's like the due process of immigrants?
Correct, yeah. You know, even if the laws are the laws and they're being prosecuted the way that they are, prove it. You know, I think that's a rather relatively basic standard to meet.
Calvin Rudy, Gretchen Gillis, and Richard Cappuccino are just a few of the voices of protesters who came out to join the No Kings protest this past weekend. We turn now to the question of how to meet the rapidly growing energy demands of AI. It turns out that the answer in Texas will be more fossil fuels, specifically, natural gas-fired power plants to be built across the state, which with the largest share clustered around Houston. Claire Howe covers the energy sector for the Houston Chronicle and joins us now to discuss. Claire, welcome back to Houston Matters.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It seems like we hear about AI all the time these days, but this in particular feels like somewhat of a relatively recently new development. Firstly, what exactly are we talking about here? What are these plants being built to power?
So I think when we use artificial intelligence in our day-to-day, whether that's for work or for fun, maybe we don't think about the fact that what we're using with what we're interacting with uses a ton of electricity, way more electricity than a simple Google search, for example. And that electricity has to come from somewhere. So there's been a lot of discussion from ERCOT and the session with state lawmakers about how Texas could see an unprecedented rise and are used for electricity, from natural gas power plants to supply that electricity is now what we're seeing to because of all the AI data centers that could come to the state. So data centers, they used to prefer renewable energy because a lot of tech companies have clean energy goals and net zero carbon emission goals that they want to meet. But just the scale of electricity use that these data centers need, tech companies are starting to think that renewable energy isn't enough for their demands. Also, AI data centers run 24/7. So there's also concerns that, you know, solar and wind power, they're dependent on the availability of the sun shining or of the wind blowing. And so they want a more consistent, reliable source of power that, you know, can be controlled by human forces, turned on and off or adjusted. So that's kind of what the preference for natural gas power plants we're seeing now. And so there's this expected boom in natural gas power plants being built across the state, not necessarily to directly connect to the Texas power grid, but many of them to connect directly to these data centers. And this new report from the Environmental Integrity Project, an environmental nonprofit, looked at all the proposed projects so far from the beginning of last year until April. And it's unlikely that all will be built. Any still are in their initial stages, but what they found doing that analysis is that the Houston area has the largest cluster of proposed power plants.
Yeah. I wanted to hone in on something you mentioned there. So these plants are being built specifically for these data centers. They're actually not being built to necessarily supplement the statewide grid. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated. Sometimes, you know, like they're built mostly for the data centers, and some of them may have connections to the power grid to be able to support the grid. But there's also the issue of, you know, these data centers want to get online as quickly as possible. There's this race to develop artificial intelligence technologies, you know, against other tech companies, against tech companies in China. And so there's this race to get electricity as soon as possible. And sometimes, you know, there's a line. You have to get in line to connect to the Texas power grid. And sometimes, you know, they might build this natural gas power plant immediately and connect to a data center and then still eventually want to connect to the Texas power grid as well. But at first, at least, they might not want to wait in that line until they get electricity for the data center, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. Natural gas has been hyped by politicians and lobbyists for years as a cleaner fossil fuel than coal. But there is, of course, still the concerns about pollution and environmental impacts. What would that mean for Houston with so many plants in our backyard? Do we have a sense of what kind of pollution we could see from this?
Yeah, and again, the projects that have been looked at, not all of them are likely to be built just because, you know, there's in building energy projects, it's fairly common to put a project in a queue and then, you know, it might not pan out. But what the Environmental Integrity Project found that all the proposals it tracked, if they were all built, it could release enough climate warming pollution, so greenhouse gases, from as much as 26.8 million cars and trucks driven for an entire year. And in total, they found that this could increase Texas's greenhouse gas emissions by 13% over 2021 levels. And then, of course, greenhouse gas emissions, you know, that's related to climate change. And then also they would release a lot of pollution that could cause respiratory and other health problems. And Houston has already for years failed to meet federal health limits for ozone pollution. And it has some of the highest levels of particulate matter pollution in the state. So these new natural gas power plants, if they're built, would contribute to that pollution as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you've said, this is all sort of hypothetical, up in the air. None of these have been built yet. Do we have a sense of what the timeline potentially looks like for when any of these plants could be operational?
Yeah, I would say it kind of depends on who is building them. So some of the bigger companies might already have been planning these projects for years, or, you know, had them on standby ready to be built, shovel ready, as they like to call it. So that will probably get on faster in the next few years or so. And then some of the other companies that are just now, you know, looking at this AI boom and wanting to get in on the gold rush, that are just kind of, you know, just starting to develop these projects. There is an issue among developers of their shortages of key equipment. And so the wait for that equipment is like 2029, 2030 and beyond. The equipment is also increasing dramatically in cost. So I would say we'd see it in waves, maybe like the first wave of plants that were already kind of on standby and ready to be built, or from bigger companies that have some of this equipment on hand, maybe in the next few years, and then like a second wave around the 2030 timeframe.
Claire Howe is an energy reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Claire, thanks very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Up next, comedian and actor Patton Oswalt as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Joshua Zinn in today for Craig Cohen. Comedian Patton Oswalt is coming to Comicpalooza this weekend, and really, that should be no surprise. The veteran comic is no stranger to the comic book world, having been a longtime reader, collector, and writer for various well-known series, such as Batman and The Goon. He has also co-written an independent comic book series, Minor Threats, which is now in talks to become a live-action Netflix series. Houston Matters producer Brenda Valdivia caught up with Oswalt recently to discuss comedy, writing, and the D-list villains in his world of Minor Threats who fight and scrap their way to survive the chaos in their city after the murder of a superhero sidekick similar to Batman's Robin.
I've just always been attracted to how people live on the fringes, or how people live and thrive in these so-called not respectable areas of life and the arts. I mean, that might be another link for me between stand-up comedy and comic books. Both of those have always been looked at as these kind of frivolous and disposable art forms. However, within those art forms, you can get away with saying some pretty harsh truths about life that you can't, I think, normally say in other mediums. And I think that is really has kind of been attracted to those kind of thinkers, those kinds of minds that are pulled into that world. One of the things that kind of bothers me about comics, and I love comics, I read a big stack every week, I got my big stack today, is there is that state of grace where, yes, there's a character here, but this character is eternal. We're not going to kill the character off because this character is a cash cow. So with these smaller creator-owned limited series, I can get away with actually having a character die, and we're not bringing this character back. But the effects of that character's loss are going to be felt in the other characters in the world, in how sometimes the removal of someone from life affects life more than them staying. I know that's a very dark, grim thing to say, but some people have more of an effect being a memory or a symbol or a feeling or a memory of what could have been had they not died. So I always want to explore that and what that effect is on people, because that's to do that with characters who have supernatural powers, superhuman powers, can maybe push beyond time, push beyond death, but still they've lost something, that creates some real human tension, I think.
You focus a lot on these D-list villains for Minor Threats.
Mm-hmm.
They're dealing with very real problems. Marvel is really good about that, too. The Marvel universe
is fantastic with that.
Yeah. And of course, you have, you know, these famous characters like Peter Parker dealing with, you know, losing his job or just trying to pay rent. And at the same time, mm-hmm. dealing with a hero who has radiation poisoning or something like that. For Minor Threats, they're all living in the shadows of much more successful villains and heroes. And they deal with real problems. Your main character is a former villain that goes by Playtime. And she's just dealing with child custody and housing issues. And in this world, she gets caught up with a city torn apart after the death of a A-lister's sidekick. And it's traumatic. It's traumatic to look at. Now, I know you said you focus on like these fringe characters, but is there something that also drives you to have these characters grow larger in life in their own spaces? Is that the point of them?
Yes, except that if you notice Frankie Follis, who was our main character of the playtime, the supervillain playtime, if you what you see her realize is, you know, I just want to live with my head down quietly in this world. But the world won't let me live that way. Like, I'm never safe if I live that way. So the only way to actually have the safety and peace that I want is to rise up and become a queenpin of crime. That's the only way I can carve out any safety for myself, because I haven't been given any kind of legacy. And I certainly, where I'm living doesn't give me any opportunities. So in a weird way, the choice has been made for me. If I do want my daughter to be safe and a life with my daughter and a life with my ex-husband that I can maybe rebuild, I'm going to need to be more of a player than normally I would want to be. And we see her struggling with that in volume two. She's like, I don't normally live this way. I don't, you know, her partner scalpeled, like, we got to buy new offices. You got to look the look. You got to, she's like, I just, when you get money, when I was raised, you get money, you just hoard it and you have your safety and that's it. And I don't know why we're doing all, like, the other person is all about expansion and building. And she's like, let's just get safe and cover up, man.
You live a very non-traditional life. As you started talking, I realized that you've kind of had these similar points in your life. Tragedies followed you. You travel all over the world. People are constantly probably asking you to constantly do different projects, stories, directions.
I'm very lucky that way, yeah.
Yeah, and there's that constant drive to either expand or stay. Do you find yourself feeling connected with these characters like this?
I struggle with that every single day. There's some days where I'm like, I'm good where I am, let's just stop. And there's other days where I'm like, no, there's more that I want to do, or there's things that I want to do, and if I want to do them, I have to increase my status and my pull in order to get these things done. So there is that constant. You know, you don't want your life to be constant expansion and constant going after wealth or status, because then you're not doing anything creative anymore. But then you also kind of can't just hole up and ignore the world. That's a very, I think, childish way to approach. So I'm constantly struggling to find that balance. And that's a big ongoing thing with me.
And, you know, you're very personal and you're self-deprecating on stage. You talk openly about depression and mental health, and you've been through a lot over the years during doing stand-up. How much of your career, is it a relief to perform? And how much does it feel like a struggle to perform it, as much as you're exposing, you know, all these vulnerabilities about yourself?
Yeah, I've made it less and less a relief to perform, because that used to be kind of my only outlet. I've become much more mature about, you also need to find release in your daily life. Your whole life can't be a function of your art. So yes, there are things that I let out on stage and kind of deal with, but I'm also trying to be very open with my wife, with my friends about stuff, because if you're just bottling it all up for a performance, then after a while that can also hurt you. You know, so people that say, well, my art is my only therapy, it's like, well, you should also go to therapy. Like, you should also find other outlets, because part of art is you have peaks and valleys. You have times when stuff isn't quite clicking, you know, and if that's tied in with your mental well-being, then that can really lead to some dangerous stuff. So have other outlets for your mental health rather than just your art. And don't make your art a release. You know, it should be, it should always in the end be fun rather than, oh, it's a pressure valve. Oh, it's a relief. Oh, it's a lifeline. Well, if you make it that, you're going to run into other problems down the road.
Comedy is a process, especially stand-up. You're kind of shaving and working. Every joke is a sentence.
Yeah.
There's a structure. How long from writing those original jokes to filming a special do you typically spend on your stand-up? Or is kind of serendipitous?
It depends on the joke. Some jokes come out more fully formed, and so it's in stops and starts. Sometimes like 20 minutes of the hour almost springs out of my head immediately. Another 10 or 15 minutes of it, I got to work over months and months. And I'm just not that good at sitting down. I wish I was better at sitting and just writing jokes out. I can write out concepts. I can write out possible sentences, possible punchlines, but I've got to get on stage and talk it out. And then, because then it sounds more natural coming out of me.
Is it a home space or is it a touring space that you get to work these jokes out?
Definitely a touring space. When I'm on the road, that's when I really work the jokes out well. When I'm on stage out on the road.
Is it because they're more forgiving or because they don't see you often?
It's because they're less forgiving. It makes you edit. It makes you get to the nub of it, I think, a lot quicker. And you try to carve out all the non-essential stuff. And, I want things to be as lean as possible.
All right, so Dana Gould, Maria Bamford, Paul F. Tompkins, Janine Garofalo, Joe Hodgson, they've cemented themselves along with you as alternative comedians. I've heard this label come up over and over again. These alt comics. Is comedy tribal, or are there lines of humor that transcend?
It's definitely tribal and has become more tribal with the internet age. I mean, for alt comedy for us was just, the audience has no expectations from the comedian, and the comedian has no expectations from the audience. A lot of times with comedy, an audience is there, and they're like, I'm expecting a certain rhythm and a certain subject matter. And then a lot of times, hackier comedians are like, well, they just want to hear this, 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 and this. So I'll just give them this. So there's not that, no one's being surprised. You got to remember, alt comedy wasn't people that didn't do comedy and invented a new form. Alt comedians were like seasoned road comedians that had gotten to the point where they're like, well, I can do the road stuff, but it's so boring and I want to push and do something new. So that's where that came from, wanting to do something new, wanting to push.
Who are the people that pushed you?
I mean, before I got into comedy, it was people like Pryor and George Carlin. And once I got into comedy, it was just my circle of friends that I hung out with, you know, people like Blankenpatch and Brian Posehn and Karen Kilgariff and, you know, Margaret Cho and Greg Proops and people like that. People that I just hung out with were my influences. And because I would always try to, you know, aspire to their level.
Yeah. Is there a level of rivalry still? I mean, I'll be honest. There's nothing funnier than watching my friend bomb. Because I know they're about to turn around and do it to me. So I wonder.
I think there's rivalry when you're young. But as you mature and you realize, oh, it's actually not a, it's not a scarcity reality that we live in. There's actually room for everyone if you just do what it is that you do. And someone doing something that's experimental and more open and close to what you do just actually makes the atmosphere even more better for you. So I'm glad when somebody good gets through. I don't want mediocre hacks becoming massive because that lowers everyone's bar and lowers the expectation for the audience and you get worse audiences.
Do you ever purposely choose audiences that are, you know, are going to be riskier just to kind of vibe it up? Like, you ever like, can I get on the Apollo tonight? Let's see what happens.
I don't choose audiences. I book where I get booked, and I always am about make any audience your audience. Always treat them with respect that they're going to rise and get the joke. I never am like, oh, here I am in Iowa, or here I am on stage with the Apollo. Like, okay, we get, no, I'm just, here's what I do, and you just do what you do. If you believe in the audience and trust them and are happy to see them, they always rise to the occasion.
There are some comedians who dig down before they climb up. Like Bill Burr is known for making a very outlandish statement and then bringing the audience to see his point of view. Others, they kind of aim for like a softer point and then kind of build from there. Do you like antagonizing your audience? Do you want them to be with you right from the beginning?
Well, what Bill does is just another version of making any audience your audience. He trusts that they'll come around to him. I don't think of it as him digging in and trying to shock the audience. He's like, this is how I think, and I'm welcoming you along to it. But I don't think he's going, I want to shock the audience. He's like, they'll get what I'm doing. They'll come around to what I'm saying. Like, it's just that confidence, you know, and that confidence comes from being excited to perform. So there's, you know, however you relate to other people, whether it's personally or on stage, that's just a form of making any audience your audience.
How do you know when you have them?
The moment when you really realize you have them is when you realize, oh, I don't have to have a joke a minute. I can just talk about things. And if I'm interested in it, and it's an interesting thing I'm talking about, they'll stay focused. So it's more like, oh, we're sharing this.
Now, there are the three big versions of live comedy. You have sketch comedy, you have stand-up, you have improv. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are different sections kind of all evolve from there. Mm-hmm. Are there ever times that you want to switch over what kind of performance you're doing on stage?
No, I love sketch and I love improv, but stand-up is my thing. I mean, stand-up is what brought me to the dance, and I still love it, and
I think they're all valid forms. So I'm never like looking over at the other line. You know, I'm just like, I got my thing and I really love doing it. So I've always just been happy where I am.
Now, you have done a lot of performance on screen, like AP Bio and performing for a camera. Like, what do you even have to consider for doing that? Because with an audience, you have that live reaction, but with a camera, it's just there.
Well, with an audience, it's more like you are the, you're the igniter. Like, you're the one who's putting the stuff out there and then they're responding. With, especially acting on camera, whether it's a sitcom or a film, acting is about listening and being present and not always waiting for you to have the thing to say. So you have to be, in a way, even more confident and more calm to take the time and listen to the other people and let stuff happen. So, you know, it's two completely different muscles. Again, I think they're both valid, and I've never been like, oh, I just want to be an actor. Oh, I just want to be a comedian. I get to do both, and I don't question it. I'm happy to get to do both of them, you know?
You did something called The Comedians of Comedy, Brian Posehn and Maria Bamford, I believe Zach Galifianakis, and that was the early 2000s. And that felt so much like, this is work, but I'm also watching friends hang out and people who genuinely like each other. How important is it for creative projects to work with people you just like?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate goal. It's to paraphrase John Waters, I want to make enough money so that I don't have to work with a-holes. You know, I just want to do, and again, so much of your creative stuff comes from hanging out with people that you like and people who are kind of on your same wavelength, you know, so I wanted to show that that's another really great benefit of going into a creative life is you get to hang out with other creative people, and it's really, really fun.
Actor and comedian Patton Oswalt, who's the co-author of the comic book series Minor Threats. He's scheduled to appear this weekend at Comic Palooza at the George R. Brown Convention Center. He spoke with Houston Matters producer Brenda Valdivia. Up next, we welcome your dog and cat care questions at talk@houstonmatters.org, or you can text or call 713-440-8870 as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Joshua Zinn filling in today for Craig Cohen. Once again, Houston Matters goes to the dogs and cats as we welcome your questions about the care and feeding of your canine and feline friends for veterinarian Dr. Lori Teller from the Meyerland Animal Clinic and Texas A&M University. Dr. Teller, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And we welcome any questions you have about the dog or cat companion in your life. Call or text us at 713-440-8870 or talk@houstonmatters.org. So with the summer ahead of us, a lot of folks are maybe looking to head out on vacation, and that might include taking along their furry companions. What are some basic things to remember before, let's say, if you're driving a long distance with a dog or a cat?
Which is how most people travel with their dogs and cats, so there's certainly plenty that fly. And the advice really applies to anybody traveling with their dogs or cats. Make sure they have some kind of identification, microchip, and a tag would be awesome. A phone number where you can be reached wherever you are. So typically a mobile phone should be on the tag. Make sure your pets are current on their vaccinations, especially rabies. That is a law in all 50 states. And have a copy of those vaccination records with you in case you need proof of them. If you're flying, the airlines may ask. At a hotel, the hotel may ask. So all of those things are important. If possible, pack your pet's food. An abrupt diet change on top of the stress of travel could cause some GI upset that you'd rather not have, particularly in a place where you may not have an established veterinarian. So food, the bowls, leashes for your dogs, an appropriate size kennel for dog or cat. All of those things are going to be really important. And then, of course, if your pet does have some kind of chronic medical condition, having enough medicine to cover your trip, identifying where a veterinarian will be at your final location in case you need a checkup, and having a copy of your medical records with you.
So you kind of alluded to this. What do you do if, while you're out in an unfamiliar town and you have a veterinary emergency, mm-hmm. what are the options that you can take? Because your usual vet's not there.
That's right. So there are some triage services that can help you, telehealth, that you can find online that can help you identify, one, is this truly an emergency or is this something that can wait, and can give you some advice, perhaps help you find a veterinarian in the area. You can still call your local veterinarian, the one at home, and see if they know somebody in the area. And of course, if you can plan ahead before you leave, which sometimes is doable and sometimes is not, but identifying a veterinarian in the area where you are traveling to would be ideal. If not, you may be asking for recommendations from a hotel concierge or an Airbnb, neighbors, things like that, wherever you are. And of course, if all else fails, Google.
Yeah. So similar to that, when you're traveling, you're probably going to be staying in hotels, Airbnbs. You're going to be eating out at restaurants. Mm-hmm. And if you have your companion with you, are there hotel and restaurant chains that are usually pet friendly? Is that something you'll have to think about as you're making your travel plans?
You definitely want to know ahead of time that every place that you are staying accepts pets. It would be horrible to arrive somewhere and find out, oh no, we don't take pets. Some places will have size restrictions on pets. So some may say we accept dogs up to 25, 30 pounds. Not ideal to show up with your Labrador or Great Pyrenees. They will exceed that size. So know ahead of time, know what their policies are. Some will require a pet deposit. Some may have a non-refundable pet cleaning fee. So know what that's going to look like as well.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Joshua Zinn. On the third Monday of each month, we welcome your dog and cat care questions for veterinarian Dr. Lori Teller. There's still time to call or text 713-440-8870 or email us at talk@houstonmatters.org. You mentioned making sure to have enough food on hand. How much food should you plan to bring on a summer road trip?
So have a good idea of how much your pet eats on a daily basis and take whatever that amount. Say you're gone for a week, so 7 days of, say my dog eats 2 cups a day. So I would take 14 cups of food. I'd also throw in a little extra. Maybe your trip gets delayed, extended for whatever reason. If your pet is on a regular, easily available food, of course, you may be able to run to the store and get some more of it. But I think, say you're gone for a week, I'd plan on taking a 10-day supply of what that looks like, just in case some gets lost or accidentally thrown away, you have it. Certainly, if your pet is on a prescription diet, then you definitely want to make sure you have enough to cover your trip, plus some extra, because it can be really hard to have to run out on an urgent basis and track that down.
And I would suppose the same kind of goes for water. You should make sure you have enough water on hand.
Have water. Most places you go, you'll have access to water.
Right.
So that shouldn't be a problem. At some point when we talk about hurricanes, we will talk about having enough water on hand to make sure you cover your pets as well. But also take bowls. Some pets are very open to eating and drinking out of whatever container is available, but others are more routine driven. And so if you can have the bowls they're used to eating and drinking out of available, that will help reduce their stress.
Speaking of routines, how do you prepare a dog or a cat who is used to living indoors for, you know, a long trip that's going to have them on the road for multiple days?
Anything that you can do to go for a drive, several drives before you actually travel, will be very helpful. Lots of dogs are used to car travel. Cats tend to not be used to car travel because the only place they tend to go is to the veterinarian, which doesn't always have happy associations. So if you can put your cat in the carrier and go for a drive, maybe you do the 610 loop or something like that, just to make sure your cat is comfortable in the car. Make sure they're also comfortable in the carrier, both dogs and cats. minutes before you go. And that may mean leaving the carrier in your living area with the door open, perhaps feeding them in the carrier so they have good associations with being in the carrier, or putting a favorite treat in the carrier, just so they're comfortable in the carrier. The other thing that is helpful to do these practice drives before you actually travel is you'll find out very quickly if your pet gets motion sickness. Not super common, but definitely not uncommon. Certainly if they're throwing up in the car, that's a sign. But some pets may just salivate excessively, drool. Some you may not see that, but they may lick their lips, like lip smacking more than usual, and just kind of have that general nauseated look. And if your pet does have motion sickness, then you do want to talk to your veterinarian. Some great medications available to control that, but you want to know that before you actually embark on your journey.
What about camping? What if you're taking your pet out to camp? And again, what if they're usually indoors? Are there extra considerations you kind of have to think about if you're going to be spending a lot of time just outside?
Definitely. So camping can be lots of fun, but it can also be some extra work if you're taking your pet. So I would not make that your pet's first exposure to the great outdoors. Again, do some practice hikes, walks, things like that. Make sure your pet is comfortable on a leash. That's going to be of the utmost importance. You don't need to be out camping and risk your pet running off and getting lost on your trip. Again, the permanent identification, knowing that your pet is comfortable sleeping in something besides your bed is going to be important. Especially if you're on a camping mattress or using an air mattress, that can be a different kind of texture for your pet. So making sure they're comfortable with that. Fleas, ticks, mosquitoes, all of the bugs of the great outdoors can also impact our pets. Make sure your pet is on an excellent flea and tick prevention. Be aware that mosquitoes can bite them just like they bite us. There's really not great insect repellents for pets. There's one or two that are topical and available. But in general, they can get itchy from mosquito bites. Talk to your veterinarian ahead of time should you pack Benadryl to go, other antihistamines, medications for potential GI upset, minor first aid tricks, things like that.
This is Houston Matters. We're talking with veterinarian Dr. Lori Teller, taking your pet care questions. You can still call or text 713-440-8870. You can email talk@houstonmatters.org. So we've talked a lot about driving, road trips, but there are the chance that people may be flying to their destination. What do you need to think about when you're flying with your dog or cat? And what's allowed these days? What should you prepare for?
So definitely check with your airlines before you go. Every airline has its own rules about flying with your dog or cat. Some will require not only proof of rabies, but a health certificate that has been completed by your veterinarian within the past 10 days, usually, which will also require a physical exam and your veterinarian stating that your pet is healthy enough to travel. Then, depending on your pet's size, it may be able to fly in the cabin in a carrier under the seat in front of you. So super important to make sure your pet is comfortable in that carrier. Other pets will have to fly in the cargo hold. These are pressurized, so comfortable for your pet, but still very stressful. Lots of noise, strange environments. So your pet really needs to be able to adapt to unusual or different situations. So know how your pet responds to stress. In general, we don't recommend sedating a pet that's going to be flying in the air, especially if it's flying in the cargo, because it can impact the pet's ability to balance in the carrier and make it disoriented. We don't know how it can impact its breathing. So those are things to take into consideration as well. A mild sedative for a pet that's flying in the cabin may be okay. Again, you can have an idea of how your pet does with travel with practice runs in the car, but recognizing that air travel is still going to be different. You also want to avoid, in the summer, the hottest times of the day to fly. especially with flight delays and things like that. You don't want your pet out sitting on the hot tarmac for extended amount of times before it gets loaded on the carrier. Certainly make sure that it's had the chance to go to the bathroom before you check in. And you want to feed a small meal 2 hours or more before your estimated departure. You don't want to feed it too close to when they're going to be taking off.
Let's take a call. Tracy's on the line from Houston. Tracy, what's your question for Dr. Teller?
Good morning. My question is, so I have a large, German Shepherd. She's very sweet, but people tend to be afraid of German Shepherds, I think. And so when I drive long distances, sometimes by myself and the dog, I have to stop at her rest stop. What's your advice for what to do, or like a gas station, you know, to go in for a bathroom break? What's your advice about what to do with my dog in that situation?
So if it's a potty break for your dog, find a place to walk your dog on the side of the gas station and let that happen. If you have a way of leaving your car running with the doors locked just to keep the air conditioning going, that would be ideal. Some gas stations, especially along the major highways, will allow you to bring your dog in, something just to check with the clerk behind the counter. The big thing is to make sure your dog isn't locked in an air-conditioned vehicle. Even with the windows down, it can get really hot really quickly, making sure water's available on the brakes, things like that. There are a lot of sweet German Shepherds out there, but people have a fear, sometimes unwarranted, of them as well.
We have a question from David that actually came in last month that we didn't get to. He wrote that he has an indoor cat who recently started to want to go outside for short stretches, maybe an hour or so, mostly just sits on the back porch. But since he started doing that, he comes back inside and will sometimes have these long sneezing attacks. Is he allergic to something? What's going on? Just want to make sure I'm not ignoring anything problematic.
Yeah, well, I'm glad your cat gets to enjoy to the back porch and watching the scenery. Some great environmental stimulation there. As long as he's not running off. Sneezing is probably either something that's irritating his nasal passages, or he could be allergic to something, just like all the rest of us in Houston, human and animal alike. Allergies are pretty common, and certainly the tree pollens have been active. So it's very possible that while he's out there, he's breathing in something that can be very irritating. And once he comes in, especially in the cooler environment, he just has sneezing attacks to clear it. If he's otherwise acting fine, eating, drinking, you're not seeing profuse nasal discharge, particularly of a yellow or green color, then I think you're good just watching it. And certainly if you notice abnormal discharge, then talk to your veterinarian.
Dr. Lori Teller is a veterinarian with Meyerland Animal Clinic and teaches veterinary medicine at Texas A&M University. Dr. Teller, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, player conduct and the impact on professional sports teams. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. Houston Texan safety Jimmy Ward was arrested last week on charges of felony assault, family violence, and could potentially face suspension if the National Football League determines that he violated their personal conduct policy. Ward is currently out on bond while an investigation gets underway. This is sadly far from the first time an athlete has been under scrutiny for their personal conduct off the field of play, though the results of those incidents tends to depend on the individual case and what a given league's policy dictates. Still, in some cases, it seems that certain actions can lead to the veritable end of a player's career, while others seem to have minimal impact on their reputation. In the age where everyone's conduct seems up for scrutiny because of how connected we are, how does and how should an athlete's off-the-field behavior influence their career prospects? Let's discuss now with Believe in Astros podcast co-host Jeff Balke. Morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Let's start with the case of Jimmy Ward, who was arrested and charged with a crime, but has not been officially convicted of anything. Is it safe to say that even a simple arrest and an accusation like this can impact a player's reputation?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the NFL has its own investigative team who will go in and they will try and make a determination. So even if, for example, he is no-billed or isn't prosecuted for anything, the NFL can still suspend someone for violating its code of conduct. And so they'll definitely investigate it. Every sports league has their own team to go in and investigate these things, regardless of what happens with a police case.
What about another case that was close to home a few years ago? Former Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson was accused by multiple women of sexual assault beginning in 2021. He didn't end up facing criminal charges and settled the civil lawsuits brought by the accusers, but he did face a suspension from the league. And ever since then, his career really hasn't seemed to recover, has it?
Well, in Deshaun Watson's case, it's a little different because his career hasn't recovered because of his poor play on the field.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things that you find out with in most sports is that things tend to be pretty easily forgiven if the players are really, really good. And if the players aren't very good, then it's pretty easy to dismiss them. In the case of Deshaun Watson, he struggled with injuries and poor performance, and that just has compounded the problems that he had off the field. But it doesn't always work that way, but it certainly sometimes can.
Yeah, I was curious, does it usually depend on, you know, kind of the level of star power the player has? If they're particularly popular or skilled at the game, do they tend to get off a little easier for controversial extracurricular activity?
I mean, I think that's true in almost any situation, regardless of whether it's sports or Hollywood or anything else. And yeah, I think it definitely happens that way. Now, it depends on how egregious the conduct is. It depends on the criminal charges that are involved, if there are any. But if a player doesn't face criminal prosecution, then oftentimes, yeah, they get. I mean, look, Kobe Bryant was accused of rape. It never went to criminal prosecution. There were numerous people who, you know, could corroborate some of that evidence. But his career didn't suffer at all. And so there have been many instances of players and even players who've gone to prison who came back and ended up playing. And so it does happen. And I do think star power does have an impact.
And so far we've talked mostly about NFL players, but you did mention Kobe mm-hmm. Bryant. I mean, what about other sports? Do we see this kind of thing happening in baseball, basketball, other professional leagues?
Yeah, I think you certainly see it in every professional league. My personal feeling is that you tend to see it a little bit more in the sports where there is a little more violence involved just in general. You know, in the NFL, you tend to see it because, well, it's a violent sport. It's an aggressive, you know, testosterone-fueled sport. And I think when it comes to especially domestic violence or some of these other things, it can be a problem. Also, the NFL has such a short window for a career that oftentimes you have guys who, you know, are in the league for a couple of years and, you know, they get into trouble because they're trying to preserve whatever financial, you know, wherewithal they have because their career is going to be so short. So I think in the NFL, you might see it a little bit more, but I think it definitely happens in all of sports, just as it happens throughout society. I think when you fuel popularity and money and all sorts of other things together, it definitely creates problems.
And so we've talked about individual players and kind of the prospects on their career. What about the teams that they play for? Do these instances have an effect on the teams at large?
It really depends on how the teams and the leagues handle it. I mean, I think that is really the bottom line is, how does a team handle something like this? How does a league handle something like this? And it really varies depending upon who they're dealing with. You know, the NFL took a big hit with Ray Rice, who, you know, was said to have been involved in domestic assault. And then suddenly it appeared there was a video of him assaulting his wife. And it sort of changed the dynamic of that whole thing. There have been plenty of Deshaun Watson was a player the Texans moved on from. I think it made the Texans look good. It's made the Browns look terrible. And so I think that's part of it. You know, how a team handles it, how a league handles it, what they do about it at that moment and what they do about it going forward is critically important to the reputation that they build.
Does it feel like the culture on this is changing, especially compared to previous decades? Are our minds becoming more sensitive to these kinds of things?
I don't think there's any question just simply because society has changed. I think there's a lot less of a boys will be boys mentality that exists within sports that used to exist. I mean, the fact of the matter is when you go back in history and you look at what happened to athletes and things like that in the past, if you go back 30, 40, even 50 years, there were players that were given passes for all sorts of things. Police didn't arrest them, or they got off on minimal charges. That just doesn't happen as much anymore. There's a much less patience in our society for people who break the law, no matter who they are.
Jeff Balke writes for the Houston Press and co-hosts the Believe in Astros podcast. Jeff, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
And that'll do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Craig Cohen, Michael Haggerty, Brenda Valdivia, Mincho Jacob, and Laura Walker. Jared Carroll is our technical director. On tomorrow's show, continuing our visits with upcoming Comicpalooza guests, we talk with actor Alan Tudyk ahead of his appearance this weekend. And we consider the role that megachurches play in a city like Houston and our society at large. I'm Joshua Zinn. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.